Welcome to episode 105 of the People's History of Ideas podcast. This episode, we're moving on from Nikolai Bukharin's opening speech at the 6th Congress of the Chinese Communist Party to talk about the Congress in a more general way. So first, some basic facts about the Congress. It was held in a Moscow suburb in what had been an old manor house from June 18th to July 11th, 1928. There were 84 delegates in attendance with voting rights and a further 54 people attending without voting rights. Apparently, the general atmosphere at the Congress, as the Congress opened, was one of political disorientation caused by the severe defeats that the party had suffered. And there was an expectation on the part of many attendees that the Comintern would provide concrete political guidance for the road ahead. So while I've noted in past episodes, and we'll probably note again in this episode, the heavy-handed way in which Bukharin and other Comintern leaders treated the Chinese communists at this Congress, it is worth noting that the majority of attendees were definitely looking to the Comintern for leadership. That first speech by Bukharin took up the first two sessions and lasted for 9 hours. I know that back in episode 102, I said that I didn't know how long the speech lasted precisely, but I have since found a source that gave 9 hours as the length of that speech. Bukharin's speech was followed by a similarly lengthy talk by Chu Chubai in his capacity as head of the Provisional Politburo that had been appointed at the August 7th, 1927 emergency conference. Most of Chu's talk consisted of explaining and summing up the history of the Chinese Revolution and the Chinese Communist Party. As you might imagine, of particular concern to the Congress was coming to a better understanding of how the United Front with the Kuomintang had collapsed and summing up the various efforts at armed uprisings in late 1927 that followed the collapse of the United Front. Just to give you a flavor of some of this discussion from Chu's speech, here's the paragraph where he summed up the Autumn Harvest Uprising in Hunan, an event we discussed back in episode 60 and 61. Quote, "The Hunan Provincial Committee, after receiving the order for the Autumn Harvest Uprising, talked loudly about the Chinese Revolution being the 1917 October Revolution, proletarian revolution, advocated that the lands of the tillers be confiscated, that the slogan for Soviets be brought forth, and that the Kuomintang be discarded. However, in reality, the Provincial Committee was thinking about the problems of how to confiscate land according to law and to care for the poor and the weak so as to pacify the people after the party's seizure of power. It did not send comrades to the countryside to mobilize the peasants, to arouse the workers in Changsha, and to lead them in the struggle and in the uprising. Instead, it asked the Central Committee to send two regiments of troops to attack Changsha on August 31st. This was called an uprising. Obviously, this was the work of the remnants of opportunism, inseparable from the Kuomintang-style militarism and benevolent rule. At that time, Hunan was in the aftermath of the Horse Day coup. The memory of the regime of the peasant associations was still vivid in the minds of the masses, and most of Tang Shengzhe's troops were in Anhui and Hubei. Ever since the Horse Day coup, the gentry was in constant danger of being attacked by the peasant associations. Thus, the decision of the August 7th conference of the Central Committee to use the slogan of peasant association regime to arouse the autumn harvest uprisings in Hunan and Hubei was a practical policy. For this reason, the Central Committee firmly corrected the Hunan Provincial Committee's mistakes and formulated the plan for the autumn harvest uprisings in Hunan and Hubei. But the Hunan Provincial Committee suddenly lost its courage. It called off the uprising scheduled for September 16th in Changsha, and instead it staged revolts in Liling, Juzhou, and other places. The Central Committee severely reprimanded such an action and summoned an emergency meeting of the Hunan Provincial Committee and reorganized it." End quote. If you'll recall from back in those episodes, Mao himself, who led the uprising on the ground, was very critical of the role of the Hunan Provincial Committee and was himself also criticized heavily by the Hunan Provincial Committee. But their main disagreement was about the importance of building a professional army led by the communists, as Mao advocated, or just relying on armed masses, as the Hunan Provincial Committee argued for. During the course of the Autumn Harvest Uprising, as the peasant armed forces were stalled out and turned back as they marched on Changsha, and as martial law had been declared within Changsha, a decision was made to call off the proposed armed insurrection within Changsha itself and to allow the remaining peasant armed forces to retreat to the mountains, where they eventually founded the Jingangshan base area. On this point, both Mao and the Hunan Provincial Committee were in agreement. As Chu indicates here, all of this was done against the direct order of the party center. But we also saw in episode 59 what happened to the Chinese communists in Hubei province who followed party center orders to continue their armed uprising, even after everyone leading the armed uprising on the ground could see that defeat was inevitable. They all died, and the revolution was set back, not advanced, by the sacrifice that they made. In any case, what we see here in Chu's summation of these events is not a critical summation of the events as they played out and what were the strengths and weaknesses of the party as it attempted this armed action. In fact, Chu even gets some basic facts wrong. For example, Li Ling was taken by communist armed forces marching toward Changsha, and when those forces were driven out of Li Ling the next day by the Kuomintang, they were still hoping to advance on Changsha. So the seizure of Li Ling was in no way conceived as an action to be taken instead of seizing Changsha. Now, does this error in Chu's report reflect sloppiness on his part? Or is it a deliberate lie to make for a better narrative in blaming his subordinates for the failure of the uprising? Or does it reflect the continued fog of war and imperfect flow of information and the quality of reports that made their way to the party center? I couldn't tell you for certain, but it is striking that the official report to the party congress by the head of the party would contain such an inaccuracy. But aside from that point about Chu getting some important facts wrong, what really stands out is the approach taken by Chu here. Is this a summation where strengths and weaknesses can be discussed and general lessons be learned for advancing the struggle? No. The issue here is one of blame and discipline. It is implied that had the Hunan Provincial Committee not lost its courage, the uprising would have succeeded. And the matter was resolved by, as Chu puts it, reprimanding and reorganizing the Provincial Committee. Problem solved, apparently. Next time, if only the subordinates will obey the party center, surely the revolution will succeed and advance step by step in an orderly march toward victory. This at least seems to be the implication. And it calls to mind something we remarked upon back in episode 57, where we quoted from something that Zhou Enlai said in 1944 in a long report at the Central Party School in the Yan'an base area, which dealt with party history. He said that in the years following the August 7th, 1927 emergency meeting, quote, bad precedents were created in inter-party struggle. Things reached the point where in any struggle against opportunism, one or two persons in responsible positions had to be singled out and attacked as if they were opportunism itself. Once they had been removed or transferred, it was believed that opportunism had been eliminated and everything was just fine. End quote. And we can see this style being performed in Chu's summation speech at the Sixth Party Congress right here. Although the irony is that Chu himself is going to be blamed and removed from top leadership at this Congress because of the party's various defeats over the course of the past year. Following Bukharin's and Chu's reports, there was a period of open discussion at the Congress of these reports. There were some substantial disagreements among the Chinese communists in attendance. There was still a small group of people who remained politically close to Chen Duxiu and who totally opposed anything that Chu Chubai said. Then there was another small group very, very closely associated with Chu and who supported him 100%. Between these two extremes, there was a range of opinions about just how bad the errors were that had been committed under Chu's leadership over the course of the past year, and therefore how much rectification in the form of self-critical acknowledgement of error and formulation of substantially changed ways of moving forward would be necessary in order for him to continue in leadership or whether a whole new leadership would need to be selected. Before many of the comrades felt that the discussion of Bukharin and Chu's reports had been properly concluded, Chu went ahead and tried to end the conversation. The next phase of the Congress would consist of the formation of various committees. Zhang Guodao described the work of these committees as consisting of, quote, examining various reports and proposals and of drafting resolutions for final approval by the Congress, end quote. So, for example, some of the resolutions that have come down to us from the Congress include resolutions on organization, the trade union movement, the land question, the peasant question, on the question of Soviets or the local organization of political power in areas controlled by the communists, on military affairs, on propaganda work, on the work of the Communist Youth League, on the women's movement, a resolution to fix a regular memorial day to commemorate the Guangzhou uprising, a resolution on the need to draft a party program, and a resolution on the question of national minorities. There was also a political resolution which was drafted, which was based on Bukharin's report to the Congress. All of these reports were the work of committees, or we might call them working groups, formed during the Congress. Anyways, what happened was Chu Chubai tried to cut short the discussion of his and Bukharin's reports, which had opened the Congress, taking up the first four sessions or so, before many comrades felt that the reports had been fully discussed. He did this by putting forward a slate of candidates to form these various committees, which would spend the next phase of the Congress working to put together these reports. This slate of candidates to form these working groups excluded people who disagreed with Chu, and so he really aroused a lot of opposition from the delegates to the Congress. And as I mentioned a minute ago, most delegates felt that he needed to demonstrate some level of self-critical acknowledgement of error, even though there was not unanimity on how far this needed to go. So when he put forward this slate of candidates for the working committees of the Congress, which would put together the various resolutions that would later have to be discussed and then finalized by the Congress, he clearly signaled that he was not very open to a serious acknowledgement of error and political change of course. So when Chu Chubai put forward this loyalist slate of candidates to form the working committees of the Congress, there was a big outcry, and eventually his slate of candidates was voted down. Chu, I think correctly, interpreted this as a vote of no confidence and stormed out of the conference hall to go and call on the Comintern for help in dealing with the situation. According to Zhang Guodao's account of the Congress, quote, as a result, the Comintern sent four experienced officials who, partly by pressure and partly by mediation, eventually managed to have the slate amended acceptably and approved by the Congress, end quote. Working groups were finally created on the seventh day of the Congress, and in addition to the committees formed to write the resolutions mentioned earlier, there were also two committees formed to review the strategic errors of the Nanchang Uprising and Guangzhou Uprising, respectively. However, these committees were dissolved 2 weeks later by the Comintern representative who was most involved in overseeing the Congress, who thought that the executive committee of the Comintern should take responsibility for these reviews. This was a man named Pavel Mif. He was the Comintern's top China specialist and was the head of Sun Yat-sen University in Moscow, which was the Comintern's school for training Chinese communists. In these capacities, the Comintern had given him oversight responsibilities for the Chinese Revolution. As head of Sun Yat-sen University, he was in the process of training a whole new generation of leading communists for the Chinese Revolution who would soon be counted on to hew precisely to what the Comintern told them to do. Zhang Guodao gives an account of the behavior of Mif's Chinese protégés at the Congress here. Quote, the activities of Chen Xiaoyu, Shen Zemin, and their group during the Congress did not work to Mif's advantage either, These Sun Yat-sen University students, who belong to the myth clique, acted as interpreters during the Congress. They were relatively new comrades who primarily took pride in being extraordinary. After hearing the mudslinging arguments among several delegates, they invariably assumed a derogatory attitude toward those senior leaders. After listening to Chu Chu Bai's half-baked interpretation of Marxism-Leninism, they often ridiculed him behind his back, believing that they knew much more than their elders. Other delegates who could not express themselves properly were criticized as lacking in theoretical knowledge. They were equally opposed to Chu Chu Bai's putschism and my opportunism, which gave the impression that in the future they should shoulder the main tasks of the party. All this was generally regarded as a move by MIF to train and cultivate new cadres in order to attack us, the original leaders of the party. This first guy that Zhang mentioned, Chen Xiaoyu, is better known to history by the name Wang Ming, and he's going to become general secretary of the party in 1931. But since it would be a little while still before these guys would be sent to China to take over, in the meantime, MIF had to contend with the current Chinese leadership. And with his continual interventions at the Sixth Party Congress, MIF managed to irritate all sides of the debates at the Congress. MIF took the initiative to reconcile Chu Chu Bai, the main representative of what was coming to be called the Putschist line, and Zhang Guotao, who, as we discussed in earlier episodes, had been given partial blame for the failure of the Nanchang Uprising and Southern Expedition at the November 1927 Politburo meeting in Shanghai, which we discussed back in episodes 71 and 72. Here's Zhang's account of MIF's effort to reconcile him and Chu Chu Bai. Quote, "This Congress, however, was held under the direct supervision of the Comintern. Though Bukharin seldom took part in the discussions, MIF, director of the China Bureau, was present at each and every session, leading his men, including the land problem expert Volin. MIF even went so far as to exert pressure on the Congress in the name of the Comintern. Once he invited me for a serious talk, during which he frankly said to me, 'It is the hope of the Comintern that you and Chu Chu Bai will be able to bury all your differences and cooperate with each other.' I told him that if Chu Chu Bai would make amends, cooperation would be no problem. He sounded me out as to whether such cooperation would be constrained. In reply, I pointed my finger at a porcelain teacup lying on the table and said, 'Well, it's just like that broken cup. Though it can be mended, the result can never look as good as a new teacup, and I do hope that nobody will ever break it again in the future.' MIF replied, 'But the organization of a communist party cannot be likened to a teacup, because a party is something organic. The Comintern is confident that it has the strength to lead the Chinese comrades, set their errors right, and make them united and able to cooperate with one another. With your approval, I will report to the Comintern to the effect that we have reached an understanding amongst us.'" I sensed that his words smacked of coercion, so I told him that I would respect the Comintern's decision. He apparently said the same thing to Chu Chu Bai and had elicited the same response from him. MIF's overbearing interference was really excessive, and it made the situation worse. Chu Chu Bai's opinions varied greatly from mine, yet after arguing them out, each of us admitted his shortcomings and mistakes and agreed to follow the majority. Things could have been solved more smoothly, but MIF apparently felt that opportunism, putschism, and the Comintern or its agents were all wrong, or else certain Chinese communist leaders were in the wrong. The whole problem was not easy to clear up, and the only way out was a decision of a coercive nature by the Comintern. It was evident that the controversy could not be solved satisfactorily in this manner. Everybody felt wronged and bore grudges against MIF for meddling. Consequently, Chu Chu Bai and I felt during the Congress that MIF was sticking his nose in too deeply, harboring an ambition to manipulate the Chinese Communist Party." End quote. So, we can see here that Chu Chu Bai and Zhang Guotao, despite very strong disagreements and some degree of personal antipathy, could reach some form of reconciliation with each other, but that myth managed to engender a fair bit of enmity in both of them. To me, the exact words that Zhang has myth saying in this account don't sound so overbearing by themselves, but I think that judging from both Zhang and Chu's reactions as related here, and also judging by how other people in other accounts talk about myth's behavior in general, he must have really leaned on these guys very hard and made a couple of people who were used to being seen as leaders really feel themselves to be subordinated to someone who, after all, had not been in the trenches with them in China. And I think it's fair to say that, aside from his direct protégés, this is the reaction that myth is going to generally engender among the Chinese communist leading cadres. Anyways, we'll be hearing more about myth in the future. I think this is a good point at which to wrap up this episode, and I think next episode we should be able to wrap up our discussion of the 6th Congress of the Chinese Communist Party. Until next time.